I'm your host, Garth Braithwaite, and this is Web Friends. Welcome, friends. This week's episode is great. You're about to hear an interview with Adam Morse, who also goes by Murmurs on the Twitsverse. Here's the thing, though. I haven't met this guy in person yet. I've exchanged a few ideas with him on Twitter, and he comes highly recommended by Christopher Joseph, who was a guest on a previous episode. So it's going to be good, but we're going to meet Adam together. Before we get to the interview, though, I can give you a little bit of background on him so you know where he's coming from. He comes from a design background. He works as a CSS and HTML developer at Salesforce in San Francisco, and he's half of the music duo Miss Jackson, though that's probably not how it's pronounced. It's M-R-S-J-X-N. He's got some excellent open source projects and just all-around talented designer and developer. So let's get to the interview, but first, a quick word from our sponsors.
This episode of Web Friends is sponsored by Campaign Monitor. Sending email campaigns doesn't need to be a chore. Campaign Monitor makes it fun, easy, and beautiful. Try your hand at their template builder and have a responsive email template ready in 60 seconds. Campaign Monitor also lets you offer their services to your clients at your prices. And if you need help creating better emails, Campaign Monitor just released a free ebook with their top 100 email campaigns of 2013. Go to campaignmonitor.com and get started today.
All right, Adam, thanks for joining us. So, first question is, what's some of the best advice that you can recall that you've received while you've been working in the industry? Or actually, any time in your life?
I think I've been really fortunate in that I feel like a lot of really smart people have given me a lot of really great advice. But I think there are three quotes that I think really changed and impacted my career. The first was my first web job. I was an eager beaver, and I really wanted to learn CSS. And the guy next to me, I knew was very good at web development, and he was a great designer. And so I was like, yo, how do you get really good at CSS? And he just looked at me and said, read the HTML spec like three times and just learn HTML inside and out, and that will make you better at CSS automatically. And that was some of the best advice I ever got. And I did that. I read the HTML spec a few times. And, you know, I was a designer. Reading a spec like seemed like the craziest thing in the world to me that wizards and like back rooms of geniuses did. But, you know, I read it and it's like a bunch of words that humans put together. And it taught me a bunch of things about how the internet worked. And it wasn't that hard. And there was some stuff I didn't understand. But for the most part, it was pretty wonderful. And so that kind of trained me to be comfortable reading specs, which is, I think, really helped me develop my skill set over the last few years. Just kind of being comfortable, like sitting down and reading documentation and having that be one of the first things I do when I approach anything.
Yeah. I like that advice. It's almost, don't even necessarily understand it. Just read it. Something will set in.
Exactly. And then another piece was I was talking to an engineer that I was working with very excitedly about something that I was trying to build. And he kind of dismissed my whole thing. And I was like, man, but it would be so cool if we built this. And he said, yeah, but it's been done before. I was like, so what? Like, it would be cool if we did it. And he kind of looked at me and was like, yeah, I guess I'm not really interested in doing things that other people have already done. I'm interested in doing stuff that nobody else has done before. And that really, my young self, like really shifted how I thought about my own expectations for myself. I don't think there's anything wrong, especially in the beginning of your career of, you know, trying to parrot stuff and like learn patterns. But I think I was really entertained with just building things that had already been built before. That kind of, I had to think about that for quite some time and how I could apply that to the types of things that I wanted to build and the types of questions I wanted to ask about the work I did. And I think the third was kind of along the same lines. It was the same job. It was a guy who sat like a couple feet away from the other one. And he asked me one day, he's like, who do you think the best in the world at what you do is? Who's that person? And I had kind of a couple names that I thought about. And he just said, your job is to try to know more than those people. And again, I don't even know if that's possible, but it was a different, I realized that like that wasn't my expectation for myself. Like I didn't wake up and just try to I kind of assumed that like everybody was going to be smarter than me. Everybody was going to be better than me no matter how hard I worked. And yeah, I think just expecting more from yourself is something that a few people have taught me. I remember my very first job, I looked over and I was like, hey, man, what are you doing? This guy said, oh, I just submitted a patch to jQuery. And I was like, what's a patch? And he's like, well, I found a bug in jQuery and I fixed it and I'm like submitting it to them. And I remember sitting there and I was like, what? But jQuery is like perfect. Like a wizard made that. Like it's fine, right? And this is back in like 2005, right? Or like 2006. And of course, jQuery wasn't perfect. Like no software is like bug free. But in my mind, this was, this was a world that like I couldn't belong to. I couldn't touch. And yeah, I've had a few people kind of along the way guide me and say like, no, like we're all kind of in this together. We're all just like people trying to solve problems.
Yeah. So this is fantastic advice. This is really good. So I want to kind of pick it apart a little bit. So it's been done. I'm interested in doing what no one has done before. I noticed you haven't made a CMS. That's really weird. right? Like that most developers at some point you need to put together a CMS. That's a requirement for getting an engineer badge, I thought.
True story.
So yeah, so has there ever been a time where you're like, I know this one's been done before, but it hasn't been done right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true for a lot of things. And I definitely would give the caveat that I do a lot of things that have been done before. And I'm not completely free of that. But it's definitely something I meditate on. I think, you know, web frameworks right now, I think there's a lot of amazing work there. I think that we can do better, right? I think that we can still evolve them. I think we can make them easier to use for larger groups of people. I think there's a lot of work to be done there, but that doesn't mean that people aren't doing amazing things right now. So, yeah, in that way, I think with CSS and HTML, you're always kind of trying to solve the same problems other people have solved, but do them better. Things change, right? It's all moving targets. Browsers definitely do work differently now than they did 6 or 7 years ago. We have different concerns about responsive design than I had 10 years ago personally. I'm sure there were a couple people out there that were already hip to the trend, but for me, I mean, this is like such a moving target, and HTML and CSS is kind of simple. Like I haven't really learned that much new HTML and CSS over the last 3 or 4 years, but my mental models have changed a lot of how I think about them. And I think that kind of comes of like trying to do the same thing over and over again and finding where the holes are.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fantastic. I've been chatting with people about, trying to solve this problem. And this is something that's popped up a lot of times of people like, how do we make the perfect tool so that designers and developers can make stuff faster and easier? And the problem that I keep coming back to is you can make the perfect tool for how we're doing stuff right now, but that's not going to be how it's going to be for very long. Like the change is too fast and you're going to be spending more time updating tools than you're going to be actually solving anyone's problems.
Yeah. And that's, I think, that really strikes on like what I try to focus on when I teach design, when I talk about design, and how I approach learning is trying to learn what I want, like actual design, right? And thinking about what I actually want to build, understanding the constraints that are going to be involved in like trying to build that thing, and kind of, yeah, trying to navigate the waters of actually getting from point A to point B, like actually build the product. And for me, it's been a lot of learning code and technical stuff so that no matter what kind of changes, I can learn things. There are like mental models. There's definitely similarities. So I try not to get attached to like one language or like one mode of doing things. To me, it's like I've had to design so many different things that, you know, I didn't always design websites. And so to me, design is it's a much bigger thing. You know, you have like people design books, people design amusement parks, people design just digital interfaces that never become websites.
Yeah. So do you find that you come from a traditional, not traditional, but you come from a design background that's moved into solving problems with code?
I think, yeah, so I had a studio art degree in college and actually kind of knew nothing about design. I think I was a designer trapped in an artist's like life. And once I got really lucky and just a design firm kind of hired me straight out of school. And that's where I really learned like what design actually was. And I became familiar with this concept of just like, yep, we're going to find the problems and we're going to solve them. And there's a myriad of tools we're going to use to solve them. So my first job at college actually was working at a place that did a lot of amusement park design. So we had to do everything from storytelling to painting pictures of what stuff might look like to build 3D models that would be animated of the park with people walking around in it. So there was a lot of kind of cohesive design stuff to think about from both like how the written copy went with the visual aesthetics and talking to different cultures across the world. So that really gave me, I feel like, a good foundation of things to be concerned with, from like typography and readability to to just like making information architecture really easy to digest for your end user.
This is brilliant. So what amusement park?
Well, so that's one I got out of the game is because, like, I think they're still working on a lot of stuff that I worked on like 8 years ago. It's a really, really slow cycle. And some things never get built that you work on for like 10 years. So there's a bunch of stuff in Dubai. There's a thing called Dubai Land. And I think there's like a Lucille Doha. Were kind of two of the larger projects that I worked on. But yeah, I've kind of saw the writing on the wall that even if the project went really well, I might never see it get built. So yeah. that kind of made me sad. And it was really interesting, but it was also, I wanted to build things more quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. This is really interesting. We've been talking about in a current project at work about kind of correlations that we have with design and other creative arts or informative creative arts, things like journalism and creating videos or movies, film. There you go. That's the word I'm looking for. And how much really good stuff can oftentimes just end up on the editing floor just because you can't figure out how to get it in. And you've spent a lot of time creating that. And it's such a good skill to learn how to, not everything I do has to be published in this one thing. But at the same time, like the way that you're talking about it, it is really frustrating to work on something for so long and not get it out.
And I think it's totally rewarding too, right? Like once something actually does get built. And I think it's such a different thing to see a physical structure get built that you had a part in designing. And it's definitely a lot of delayed gratification, but I'm very impatient. So
yeah.
I like to, you can build a whole website and take it down in an hour.
And that's actually in the episode with Val Head, Seb Lee Delisle. Sorry, I always have to think about it, say his last name. But he actually gave her that advice was start cool projects and then finish good projects. Like that's so important to get that feeling of finishing and accomplishing. So awesome. Okay, so you're interested in doing things that no one has done. Then the who's the best? How do you go about figuring out who's the best?
I think, I kind of joke that there are probably like, 20 people that basically live in caves and know this stuff like cold and are not sharing their secrets with anybody and not writing blog posts and just building a crazy amount of products. So who knows? I think, it's definitely very subjective, right? There's 7 billion people on the face of the earth. A number of people doing design and front-end development and it's how far do you lean on like who's the best designer versus front-end developer versus like hybrid. I don't think there is a singular best, but there are definitely some people that I think are thought leaders and push our community in ways that really stand out. I think Nicole Sullivan, the work that she laid down years ago is priceless for our community, and she really started to ask a lot of questions that nobody else was asking publicly, at least that I was listening to. I think Nicholas Gallagher is doing like some really interesting and phenomenal CSS architecture work, and then I think Christopher Joseph is he's approaching this from ways that I don't think a lot of really anybody else is approaching it with, which is like solid software engineering principles of how to like objectively analyze the quality of our CSS. And I think we have a lot of tools to build in that regard. But I think he's making a lot of progress that nobody else is really making right now. So those are the things that are interesting to me. I think all those people really pushed our ability to change designs and build scalable interfaces. And they just articulate things really well. They communicate out ideas, I think, at a really high level. And that's, I think a lot of designers struggle with that, myself included, of we kind of know things, but we can't explain them, which obviously challenges our notion of knowing them. But, you know, how many times do you read a blog post and you're like, yes, this is why I was like, this is what I was trying to explain was the business value of like this design decision. But we're not always the best with words, which is sometimes why we're designers.
Yeah, there's so many times where I've written down, here are blog posts I want to write someday. And if I wait long enough, I tick them off one by one because someone else has said it better than I could, which is good. It's a good problem to have.
But yeah, I really think to me, it's all about the quality of the questions you ask and how hard you kind of chase answering them. I think, there are just some people that are really good at asking really hard questions and challenging our notions of our best practices because we're a really, really young community. Designing for the web is just not something, you know, we made books for like hundreds, thousands of years, not hundreds of thousands of years, but, you know, we've been making websites for a very, very small amount of time and browsers are so much different now. So we have problems that are brand new, that are like 2 years old, 3 years old. And so I'm really interested to see where our community takes it. Hopefully we can leverage some of the work that these book designers laid down for us over these many years of them working on their discipline.
Yeah. So how do you then – so once you seek out these heroes, the best, right, how do you go about I like the idea of learning more than them, know more than them. How do you go about doing that? Like do you have – even the learning part, how do you qualify? How do you set the line of this is where I've got to get to? Like, how do you know when you've arrived? Or maybe we never arrive. But
yeah, I was going to say, I guess it depends on your definition of arrived. You know, I think all of us kind of like, we'll have ideas of things we want to have agency to do, and we practice and practice. And eventually you do get to some place, right? It's not like the singular, you're all done kind of spot. But I definitely think we make noticeable jumps to certain tiers. For me, I mean, I've found that like generally people won't make you learn. They won't make you take 45 minutes to learn how to do something more efficiently or better. They'll inherently ask you to do it because they want you to build great products, but nobody will like make you read for an hour. That's just, I don't know. I've never had a job where that happens. So I'm generally fairly disciplined about making that time for myself on a daily basis of, you know, asking myself a problem or a question and trying to solve it. And sometimes it's really simple and sometimes it's really big and I don't really make that much headway. But I definitely block out some time every single day to just learn and try to just think abstractly about different problems I have and like different things I'm doing repetitively over and over and how I could kind of not do that. And I daydream a lot about just like how I want to interact with computers, how I want to design things. You know, if I didn't have the constraints of all the stuff we're constrained by right now, like what would things look like? And so to me, that's a big, big part of every single day that I do work. And that's like really, yeah, sacred part of my process.
So do you find you're at odds sometimes with the goals of your employer? Because And this isn't specifically about this employer. I'm just talking about your professional life in general. Have there been times where you felt the pressure like, hey, it's great that you want to learn, but we need to get stuff done mm-hmm. with what you already know?
Yeah, I think I think that's a constant struggle for all of us. I think one of the things I've really come to peace with is that I don't think it's at odds with what the company wants, but it's at odds with like how the company wants you to do things, if that makes any sense. So. Yeah. And I think that's the inherent tension of people not being able to do things, asking people who can do things to do stuff. It's really difficult when you don't have certain types of agency to make those decisions, right? Like, we want to normalize all this stuff. When you're actually in the weeds, like, all these problems pop up that you didn't think about before. So now you need to solve them. And when you're not in the weeds, it's hard to see that. No matter how many meetings you have or whatnot. So I think that that tension is always kind of there a little bit. But oftentimes I think that it pays off in the long run and that people will start to notice that. But it's definitely – it's kind of – I liken it to like growing bamboo, where bamboo kind of grows underground for a really long period of time. And then all of a sudden it kind of shoots up overnight. And I think a lot of the type of work that – you invest in infrastructure is similar to that. Things can be invisible for quite some time, but then all of a sudden you have a whole bunch of problems that you never have to worry about again. And you can grow things really quickly, which is, that's the world I want to live in.
That's a great analogy. The metaphor of the bamboo growing. This is good stuff. So I think there's actually like a personal level as well. There's the level of the tension with your professional job, but even on a personal level, there's often the, how much time do I spend consuming and how much time do I spend creating? Mm-hmm. Like, if all I ever do is create, I'm only going to create what I'm capable of learning on my own. And if all I do is consume, then I'll never actually apply that knowledge to anything useful. So,
yeah. For me, I generally try to do them at the same time. So CSS Uncut would be maybe a good example of this, where, so I use Vim as my text editor, and Vim's really cool because when you encounter new text editing problems, you can kind of think about them in interesting ways. And so I have basically in my CSS Uncut, each module has multiple breakpoints, and I just have basically a set of classes that get namespaced out to those multiple breakpoints. So I was finding that, you know, I would edit kind of the source, my mobile first classes, and then I would need to like copy those out to the breakpoints. And so maybe I might have like 20 classes and I might only change two. And then it's like, oh man, like which two did I change? And then now I've got to like do all this copying and namespace. So eventually I just, did some research and like, I was like, okay, how do I want this to work? Like what are the least amount of like actions I can actually make every time I make edits to one of these files? So I had to do some learning, but I thought like, well, I just want to edit this one set and then hit a button and then have all of that just magically make the rest of the file work. So that's what I did. I just recorded a macro that did that. So every single time I go to edit the file, it's just, I just have to edit this like one part of the source and then it'll automatically update all the other parts.
So here, I'm trying to wrap my brain around that because this is definitely a problem I've looked at. So you're talking about if you've got one class that's in either the default or in some media query, mm-hmm. And you want to make a change here and you don't want to change it in the media query, or you do? Or
so I'm saying, like, for instance, to make it really simple, like we'll say I have a class called Red, but I also want to namespace that to multiple breakpoints where it only targets that one breakpoint. So then I'll have a class called Red-M for like Red Medium, and then I'll have a class called Red-L for Red Large, right? And you can imagine, like, so if I have like Red, Blue, Green, and then I namespace all three of those, if I change one of them, if I change like the hex value for that Red, now I need to change that in all the media queries, and I don't want to do that, right? So I just wrote something that copied those classes and then modified the extension so it puts the dash M, the dash L in the appropriate breakpoint, and then saves the file. So I just have to edit that like one set of classes at the top.
Does it overwrite existing classes in the other namespaces?
Yeah, it blows everything away because I just want to replicate exactly what I have outside of the media query. Gotcha. Right.
There's nothing custom in that media query that's not somehow generated from the other ones.
Yeah, they should all be exactly the same. They're just targeted at different media queries. So that was a unique text editing problem that I hadn't had before. Mm-hmm. I had to learn new things as I was going along and trying to do it. So I would just keep asking myself questions of like, well, how can I do this faster? And I would Google something. And to me, those types of learnings are generally exponential. XKCD has a great chart about how long you should spend like automating things based on how long they take you and how often you do them per day. And I actually think it's like a great point of reference to look at, because it does put certain things in perspective. And when you eliminate repetitive tasks, to me, it's not just that you have more time to design stuff. You have less cognitive load weighing you down. You have more time to think abstractly about problem solving. And that for me is invaluable.
Yeah. And you get more familiar with your tools. So when you get to the point where you have to do something that's crazy, you have to do that. And you're already, your tools are sharp when it comes to the automation workflow.
Yeah. I think Kent Beck has a great quote that I'll probably mess up, but he said, not all great programmers are masters of their tools, but all masters of their tools become like great programmers. And I think that's true in design too. So oftentimes, you know, I've already thought through something that I want to see or I want to experiment with. And when it takes time to actually make it real, that's horrible. You know, and that's a frustrating thing. Like, once you actually like think through the problem and know what you want, you should be able to get that out as quickly as possible. So I spend a lot of time just trying to reduce that feedback loop so I can iterate more quickly.
And I already assume that any person who comes from a design background or experience and is using Vim as their main editor is automatically the sort of person that I want to work with, right? Like that. You can't have that combination without having a great and deep understanding of workflow. So I know that's a stereotype, but I think I'm pretty confident that it's a fantastic one.
Well, I think, you know, part of that is, and I'm excited. I mean, you definitely see a lot more designers and front-end developers starting to use, you know, Unix and Vim as, yeah, we're definitely, there are more of us now. We've been doing it longer. I just mean designers and front-end developers. And I think, you know, we're gravitating towards some of the things that have been persistent in software engineering for a while now. And yeah, I think for, you know, not that many designers run into other designers who use Vim as a design tool. But I think that it is a really powerful design tool, and it's not some scary thing you need a computer science degree to understand. It's actually like, if you don't like editing code, it's great because it does so many things and makes you have to edit code less. And you'd be amazed once you can edit text efficiently, the amount of you'd be amazed at how many code architecture decisions are based on people being unable to edit text arbitrarily any way they want to. And once you kind of can do that and have some state change manipulation, like through version control, you can really start to iterate through things in interesting ways that I could never kind of replicate a workflow like that in Photoshop. Even, you know, even learning Photoshop layers, there was just a, maybe I was just really bad at it, but there was, no matter how much time I spent trying to learn Photoshop layers, or not layers, sorry, what's the word I'm looking for?
Levels?
Maybe it's levels where you could just, it's been a while, obviously, since I've built anything in Photoshop, where you could kind of roll through, you'd have the same layers, but you could like see different iterations of a design. Anyway, there was some Photoshop thing that kind of replicated like iterating with the same amount of assets and just like changing their view, but I would always break it. And yeah, codes allowed me to just go through those types of like thoughts and questions a lot faster. And editing text is, yeah, it's a lot of fun once you don't have to do it that much.
All right. So this is fantastic stuff, and I would love for more designers to feel confident in trying out Vim and tools like that. But we want to wrap it up, but I want to get the last question because I've gone off on tangents and I apologize. But what if you had the chance to go back in time and give yourself, your past self, some advice? What would you say to yourself? What's something that you've learned the hard way that you would like to help other people with?
I think I spent a lot of time in the beginning, you know, wanting to build Rome in a day, right? Like every day you wake up and you're like, today's the day I'm going to like build an entire product from like end to finish and it'll have all the shine on it. And I think that that kind of expectation was hard. I expected myself to produce right away. And some people are smart enough and good enough to do that maybe. But I think Ira Glass really says it well when it's like, you get into this and you have great taste and you know what awesome is, you know what excellence is, you know what great design is, but you can't always just make it right away. Yeah. And I think being okay with that and learning the basics and learning about typography and grids and things that like we, you know, are just prevalent in design and kind of, not rules, but like things that we know are best practices. Learning all those things and not expecting yourself to kind of you know, build an entire product every day. I think, I think I just wasted a lot of time trying to do too much too soon. And when I took a deep breath and was patient, I felt like I learned a lot more and was able to build a lot more.
So how do you balance that though with don't be frustrated, right? Like, discouraged, I guess is the better word. If someone came up to you and said, I know you're trying really hard to make something really awesome, but it's going to take you a long time. How do you not let that set in as, it'll probably take longer than you think, and don't, it kind of makes you want to give up a little bit.
Yeah, I think, you could think of it like that, but I think you just make your goals smaller. And there's a great, my favorite book from growing up is this book called Momo. And this is probably like the life advice that was outside of my, nobody gave this to me. It was just something I read, but it's something that I've really tried to meditate on in my life, but also my design career. And there's this book Momo was written by Michael Ende, who wrote The Neverending Story. And there's a character that's a street sweeper. And he talks about basically the only way to not lose your mind if you're a street sweeper is to never look at the street that you have left to sweep. You only look at what you've already swept. And I think that that's a great way to look at learning that can kind of provide you a little more patience when you just say like, okay, you know, I can't build an entire product today, but I'm going to learn about like this one little thing and I'm going to learn it really well. You can look back in an hour and like probably have learned a really small nugget that is going to be with you for the rest of your design career. And I think that if you, just kind of are happy with making small goals and making progress, that's how I balance the tension.
That's great. Yeah. Cause I'm just thinking like I definitely can relate to that problem of trying to build Rome in a day, but on some level that mentality of, oh, I've got this, I can totally do it, pushed me to do dumb things that have made me a better person.
For sure.
And I want to make sure while I'm maturing, hopefully, and I'm learning that I can't build Rome in a day, that I also at the same time don't lose the drive. And so I like that, the street sweeper advice from Momo, you said?
Yeah. It's this book called Momo. It's, I try to reread it every few years, actually. It's pretty nice. But yeah, no, I think like the most important thing is just doing stuff. Whatever you can do to motivate yourself to just do things is really like all that matters. And you can try to be efficient about it. You can try to do whatever. But really, at the end of the day, it's like the more stuff you do, the more you're going to learn and the better you're going to get. That's just like how it is.
That's awesome. All right. Thank you.
Much, man. I really appreciate you having me on and loving all the like open source design work that you're pushing too. I wish we could have talked about that a little more. But anyway, really excited about a lot of the conversations you're starting in our community.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it. And it's been fantastic to chat with you. And everyone listening, you should go check out his website. It's mrmrs.cc, murmurs. And you're on Twitter, but it has a underscore, right?
It does. I have horrible personal branding. It's great.
So MRMRS underscore on Twitter. Yes. Yes. And on GitHub, you're also MRMRS, right?
Yes, correct. Yeah.
And there's fantastic projects in all of those places. And I just find you a delightful person to follow on Twitter. So
thanks a lot. That means a lot. You as well.
Yeah. All right. For those listening, we've got our last episode next week. It, for this season, is going to be with Brian LaRue. So tune in for that. And thanks again, Adam.
Thank you.
Adam's awesome. And it was nice to chat with him. Thanks for listening. So in today's episode, we talked about heroes a little bit. And one thing that I love about the web community is the accessibility and the approachability of most people that have become my heroes or potential mentors. If there's someone whose work you admire, you should take a second to let them know. Sometimes your hero or your mentor may not be aware what their work means to people that benefit from it. You can encourage them just by letting them know. Also, you might meet your hero someday in person, and it might turn out that you don't think you want to be friends with them anymore. And that's okay. They are fallible people, and they have bad days just like everyone else. And some of them are just not very good at being nice. And that's fine. Just find your next hero and move on. The important thing is to follow and befriend people that push you to be better. Thanks to Campaign Monitor for sponsoring this week's episode. Thanks also to the Good Stuff Broadcast Network for making it possible for us to host this show live. Go check out goodstuff.fm to find other great shows. And listen to Web Friends every week on Friday live at noon Pacific at goodstuff.fm/live. Next week, we'll have Brian LaRue as a guest, and it's going to be fantastic. It's also going to be the season finale, so tune in for that. If you like the show, please go let us know by rating it in the iTunes store. There's a link to it on webfriends.io. Thanks again for listening. You are awesome.